Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I think it is safe for me to say, and I will ask the panel if they want to take issue with me, and they're welcome to, that we are living through right now a monumental news day. It was not unexpected. Everyone was waiting for the Robert Mueller announcement that he had a plea deal with Michael Flynn. But nevertheless, when it hit the wires this morning, when we learned that Flynn was going to walk into a federal court in Washington and plead guilty to lying to the FBI, it suddenly became an enormously important news story. And we will start our show today, of course, talking about that, but we've got state and local stories we want to get into during the hour as well. I'm joined today by two AJC colleagues, Kyle Wingfield, the conservative columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We read your column, Kyle, on Thursdays and Sundays in the AJC. What do you got for us coming up on Sunday? Give us a tease.
Tearing down both the dead and the living.
You've been down to Sonoya? You're doing a walking
That's a
dead?
Spooky tease.
Yeah. You'll have to read to find out how that works out.
He's not going to say another word. Also in the studio, Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the AJC. Do you have a Sunday piece you've been working on?
I do. It's about the outsized impact of the LGBT vote, and not just Atlanta's election, but all over the metro region's elections on Tuesday.
Okay. I also should point out that we'll give a tease to this, that the AJC, I assume in collaboration with WSB-TV, has a poll coming out tonight on the Atlanta mayor's race. You haven't got all the data on that yet, but somehow I imagine you'll get roped into writing that story, too.
Yeah, we're really excited about this because it's the first poll done since the big endorsements in the Atlanta mayor's race, and it's probably the last poll that anyone will have out before the Tuesday election.
Right. Well, two AJCers in the studio, and I'm really happy that joining us in our Macon Bureau is Lori Johnson, political science professor at Mercer University. Lori, I am so glad that we got you on this monumental news day. Would you take issue with my calling this a monumental news day?
No, I completely agree. I think this is one of those days we'll look back on and think, okay, this was a turning point.
When you say a turning point how?
Well, I think that it's not about Michael Flynn. It's about the information that Michael Flynn is going to give to Mueller. And, you know, that information, there's not much higher up the chain it can go past him besides the president. So that's what we're looking at, is implicating the president in illegal activity.
Well, we'll of course, talk about that. Let me just lay out very briefly a couple of the developments today, or how this story evolved today. And it's still evolving. We're still getting information as the day goes on, and we'll update you if news breaks while we're on the air. Here are the two issues that Mueller has pled guilty on lying about. Both of them have to do with his conversations with Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador. And he told the FBI he did not meet with Kislyak and never had conversations about two important matters. One was that he apparently did, in fact, go to Kislyak when the United Nations was looking at voting on a resolution to condemn Israel for continuing to build settlements in the West Bank. And Flynn went to Kislyak urging, Kislyak and Flynn talked about how important it was that the United States not support that measure. I think I've got that basically correct. And then, and of course, they did have that conversation, and the resolution never happened. The other one, and part of that, of course, is because the Trump administration, this was before they were in office. Mm-hmm. This was while they were in transition. And, of course, the Trump administration has made it clear they're going to be closely allied to Israel. And so it makes sense that the conversation would take place to try to quash that resolution. The other discussion came up. You'll recall that the Obama administration laid out a series of sanctions against Russia when the Obama administration came forward and said, we know the Russians interfered with the American election, and we're now going to punish Russia for it. And you may recall that Vladimir Putin came back and said, we're not going to do anything right now. We're chill. We're going to let this go for the time being. And, of course, what we're learning now is that Michael Flynn, in fact, again, had conversations with Sergei Kislyak in which he essentially said, look, don't overreact to what the Obama administration is doing, because when we get in power, we're going to work all of this out. And in both cases, when confronted with those stories, he lied to the FBI. Got that right, everybody?
You got it.
Okay.
And then the quote in the document said that Mr. Kislyak told Flynn that Russia had, quote, had chosen a moderator's response. So that's laid out in great detail in those documents.
In response to his request.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the documents as well, that they didn't just decide that on their own. They were responding to the request.
Yeah. And the other major information that we got today, because it is in the documents that were laid out in court, we now know that Michael Flynn, in fact, was consulting with a higher up in the administration, in the incoming administration, the transition team, about these meetings and acting on instructions. And Lori, as you say, you can't get much higher up. You've got Jared Kushner, who could have been involved in this. You've got Jeff Sessions, who could have been involved. Presumably, you've got the vice president. The person is not named, but the final choice would be President-elect Trump himself, yeah?
I think there's even reference to the person being at Mar-a-Lago at some point.
Yes, that's exactly right.
When he communicated with them.
Yes, for at least one of those sessions.
And on the Israeli incident, the New York Times is reporting that Kushner did take the lead in those efforts to talk with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, about that effort to lobby other countries to help Israel squash that United Nations Security Council resolution.
Kyle, how are you filtering all this information right now?
Well, clearly, you know, as you said at the beginning, this is something that was kind of telegraphed ahead of time with some communication between Flynn's lawyers and Trump's lawyers. And so you knew that they were probably going to be striking a deal, and that meant cooperating with prosecutors and therefore not cooperating with other defense lawyers. I think what we don't know yet, I mean, this all happened during the transition. There was a reference in one news report that I don't believe they've repeated, and I haven't seen anywhere else, that this was Trump as a candidate saying this. So far, the only place we have it documented is that it was in the transition. If that's as far as it goes, this incident in a vacuum is probably not a huge deal. But you have to worry about, if you're Trump, what Flynn is telling Mueller and the investigators beyond this, because they caught him in this lie.
Yeah.
And so that's where we don't know, and we could spend all afternoon speculating, and it could go in any number of ways. But what we know right now is that you have previously one of Trump's campaign managers pleading guilty to some business dealings unrelated to the campaign before the campaign and cooperating with prosecutors. You have a foreign policy advisor, low level, but still representing the Trump campaign outside the United States, pleading guilty as well to lying to FBI agents. And now you have, so that's before, that's during, and now you have Flynn after. So, you know, is this just sort of a thread of sleaze that happened in parallel to everything happening in the Trump team? Or is it kind of you connect the dots and it looks like a noose tightening around the neck of the Trump team?
So, Lori and Greg, let me say what I think I heard Kyle say, make sure I hear Kyle correctly. The reason that Mike Flynn right now has made a plea deal is that he has committed a crime in lying to the FBI about not having had these two meetings. So that clearly is criminal activity. If, in fact, the person who ordered him to do this is Jared Kushner, is the vice president, is even Trump, that is in and of itself, it's a violation of the Logan Act, presumably, which, nobody has paid any attention to. But if none of them have, in fact, lied to the FBI or to the special prosecutor about their involvement in this sort of thing, what Kyle is saying is those people are not necessarily vulnerable to being prosecuted. Is that a fair way to look at what where this stands right now?
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Lori.
I would say no. I mean, I think part of it is because you have to look behind what's happening on the surface. And so someone as sophisticated as Michael Flynn, he's a lieutenant general, he headed up the Defense Intelligence Agency, is not going to accidentally lie to the FBI.
Right. But that's
he
what
is
Kyle's
going to
saying.
Lie to cover up something
right,
else
right,
that's worse.
Right, right.
And so the what he why he lied is a really important part of this.
And
question.
I think that's what Kyle's saying. Go ahead.
And the second part is the plea agreement is also just the surface.
Yeah.
He wouldn't enter a plea agreement for just these two charges if that was all he had done. We can almost know for sure he's done other criminal activity that he's negotiated away in exchange for his cooperation.
Yeah. And I think, thank you, and I think that's basically, I hope that's kind of what I was trying to say, that Jared Kushner, Donald Trump, the vice president, anybody, they may not, if they have not lied to the FBI about this, may not be in jeopardy. But it's the underlying issues that may have been going on.
And let's be clear. I mean, the plea agreement requires his full cooperation. Yeah. He has to provide prosecutors information on any and all matters they request. He has to submit to a polygraph test and participate in covert law enforcement activities, which means he could have already done some of this stuff.
Yeah, he could.
Yeah, I think the question here is for it to really get to the whole the underlying premise of this investigation, that there was collusion, right? I mean, that's what we're trying to find out. That's what Robert Mueller is trying to investigate. I think the one question you have to ask yourself is, what did Flynn know about what may have happened during the campaign? Because what he's doing...
And the transition.
What he's doing as a representative of the administration during the transition is very different from some collusion with a foreign government to help a campaign win an election. I mean, those are two very different things, and we need to distinguish between them. Transition teams have talked to foreign governments, I would hazard a guess, in numerous lead-ups to their inauguration. Campaigns working with foreign governments to try to get, say, emails of their opponent released by a foreign government, that's something altogether different, and that's what the investigation's about. So does Michael Flynn know something that he can place in Mueller's hands about happening during the campaign? That's what is really interesting here to
and
ask.
And the question is, if prosecutors want to flip him, or if they are flipping him, how credible is he?
Yeah, you're right.
They've definitely flipped them. But how credible is he as a witness if he has now pled guilty to lying?
And to the question of other crimes, we know he did some work for the Turkish government, didn't register for that properly. And some of the same stuff that Paul Manafort was pleading guilty to. Didn't disclose
his work for either country on his national security clearance form.
Right, right.
I mean, there's either a level of hubris going on here that they really don't think they can get caught, or there's something else that they're covering up that's even worse. I mean, this is the concern I have with the judgment that's being exercised here, that, you know, at each stage of the process, when he had a chance to come clean, he did not.
Here's what Michael Flynn said in his statement after he entered his guilty plea. After over 33 years of military service to our country, including nearly 5 years in combat away from my family, and then my decision to continue to serve the United States, it's been extraordinarily painful to endure these many months of false accusations that I have stood for, but I recognize the actions I acknowledged in court today were wrong, and through my faith in God, I'm working to set things right. My guilty plea and agreement to cooperate with the special counsel's office reflects a decision I made in the best interest of my family and our country, and I accept full responsibility for my actions. You know, it's interesting, Lori, that for weeks there's been speculation that this would happen, that Flynn, when he severed, his lawyers severed their ties with Trump's lawyers, we all speculated, did that mean he was cooperating? And now Michael Flynn today has said, yep, I sure am.
Well, and some people are speculating, and it is only that at this point, that his son's potential involvement in illegal activity through the corporation that he worked in with his father is also at issue, that that's something that the prosecutors can definitely use as leverage for his cooperation to decline to charge or further investigate his son.
Okay. So those are essentially the events that have transpired today. The president has not made a comment. The White House has essentially tried to suggest, as they did with Paul Manafort, well, you know, we didn't know him for very long. He was only National Security Advisor for 25 days, and he was hired by Obama to begin
with. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It identified him as a former Obama administration official.
But we should also—
Who was fired by the Obama administration.
Right, but we should point out before we take a break also that the other figure who plays a big role in all this, of course, is our very own Sally Yates, who went to the White House to warn Trump after he'd been inaugurated that Michael Flynn was a bad actor and he should disassociate himself from him. And, of course, Sally Yates was fired subsequent to that and to the way in which he handled the president's travel ban. So now that we've kind of laid out the basics of the story, what I'd love to do, let's get a break out of the way and then do a quick round with all of you about what you think the political implications of all this are. You know, what are we dealing with? And how is this going to play? Well, Trump's base will stick by him, but how many people who are have been undecided about him will move in a different direction? So let's talk about that after the break.
Thanks for listening to GPB, where listener support makes the in-depth, non-commercial news and all the programs you count on possible. As you take time to support the organizations that make a difference during this season of giving, I hope you'll include Georgia Public Broadcasting on your list. Make your tax-deductible contribution at gpb.org and click donate. From all of us at GPB, thanks for your generous support and happy holidays.
Thanks for joining us here on GPB, an 18-station service of Georgia Public Broadcasting. All things considered and Marketplace still to come this afternoon. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, the largest university in Georgia and one of the largest in the nation.
We're back on Political Rewind. Joining us from Macon, Lori Johnson from Mercer University, Kyle Wingfield, and Greg Bluestein from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Our producer, Tom Faust, just sent me a couple of breaking news stories. First, Donald Trump Jr. is going back to meet with the Senate Intelligence Committee in the Russia probe. I don't have a date on that, and I'm not sure one's been picked yet, but he is going to be talking to them, and it's clearly an important time for him to be having that conversation. And the other quick thing is on another subject entirely, but worth pointing out right now. President Trump has tweeted about Rex Tillerson. He says the news that Tillerson would be leaving soon is fake news. He's not leaving. And while we disagree on certain subjects, we work well together, and America is highly respected. Again, we'll see about that. The word this week has been that Tillerson is very definitely on his way out. Let's go back to the big news of today. Greg, let me start with you on this. How does this play out politically? Is this another one of those issues where we are going to be entirely divided? The base, if I watch Fox News, will I hear that this isn't a big deal because Flynn was an operator off on his own? And if I watch MSN, will I hear this is the beginning of the end of the Trump administration?
Yeah, you're already starting to hear that from some of his base supporters saying they spent all this money, all this time, and this is all they got. You know what they see as a relatively minor charge against a high-ranking Trump official. But what Democrats are really hoping for is a wave election next year. And if more of this kind of drivels out over the next few months, then every single Democrat in a competitive district will tie the Republican incumbent to exactly what's happening and their support for Donald Trump over the. So I think it will play a big role in the midterms next year already.
Lori, what do you see happening down Middle Georgia way? Where I mean, you're in Macon, which is a largely Democratic community, but you're also observing the community around that, which is pretty red.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, the Republican Party has been in a crisis of conscience since Trump, you know, became a viable nominee for its party. And the question you know, we were talking about the word of the year, complicit. You know, how far will the Republican Party be complicit in, at the very least, the ineptitude, if not the illegality or, you know, violation of the oath of office of the president? And so I think that you know, this is where the tax bill really does come into play. And the question of, is it worth getting that to deal, be complicit in the dealings of this administration? And I think that Republicans are going to have to sort that out. There's still time to separate themselves from it. But if they don't, then it could be consequential for all Republicans.
But you're you're surrounded by Trump voters outlying from Macon. Do you think that any of this is going to change their feelings about the president at all?
The Flynn guilty plea, not necessarily. But what's behind it? I mean, the Russia part is really key here. Russia is not our ally. Russia is our enemy. Older Republicans knew that. And how we got so far from that, I'm thinking Ronald Reagan is turning in his grave. That these are not people who play and that we should be playing with. Kislyak, for sure, is not someone to give a heads up about anything in terms of national security for the U.S.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish that sentence.
So I just think that, you know, the soul of the Republican Party has to come to grips with how far are we going to let our, you know, loyalty to the party dictate us going along with this kind of behavior.
So, Kyle, we can imagine, as Greg says, that midterm elections next year could be affected by this news and other news that's likely to develop well before Election Day in 2018. But what about here in Georgia? I mean, are we likely to see much change? I mean, we could see maybe a changeover in those couple of districts that are, you know, starting to turn much more purple, Cobb County, Gwinnett County. But is this going to affect Georgia voters who have been so loyal to President Trump?
I don't think so. I think for better or worse, Lori's question has been answered. Most voters in the Republican Party are willing to go with Trump no matter what he says, no matter what comes out about him. We saw that throughout the entire election year last year. At this point, what would it take? I'm not quite sure. I think in terms of the election next year, whether you're talking about federal offices or state offices and how turnout based on federal events might affect those state races, which is what I think you were getting at, I think the tax reform bill has more to do with whether those people show up and continue to support Republicans than anything short of a huge breakthrough on the Russia story.
And I think on the other side of the equation, it is galvanizing Democrats in ways that we haven't seen in years past. We saw that just last month with the special elections, where Democrats fielded candidates for seats that they had never even tried to contest before in the state legislature.
Yeah.
I think on the Democrats' side of the equation, you're just not going to have problems recruiting candidates. They might have a lot of them might have long shots, but they're going to be using this, even in state legislative races, as saying, I'm running against the party of Trump.
Okay, just a headline, and then we're going to come back to it a little bit later in the show because Lori and Kyle both mentioned the tax reform bill. The big news this afternoon on Capitol Hill is that GOP leaders, Mitch McConnell and others in the leadership, say they've now got the votes. They will pass the tax bill. Susan Collins, the most recent person to jump on board, she's been a big question mark for a while. Jeff Flake now says he'll support it. Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, who had been against it. So it now looks like the Senate's going to pass the bill. Let's just say that's the headline. We expect perhaps a vote before the end of... Are they still thinking they might vote by the end of today? I've been paying so much attention to
Flynn. They said
voting
will start today.
Okay, they're going to start today. All right, we'll come back and talk a little more about the details of what they're voting on. But I want to, for a few minutes, Greg, go to the Atlanta mayor's race, because there have been some interesting developments in that race. We know that it's been a dead heat between Mary Norwood and Keisha Lance Bottoms. We'll see what the AJC Channel 2 poll shows us about that with the vote just 5 days, 4 days off. But there are some interesting things going on. One, Bottoms has somebody who's becoming a bigger and bigger name in the National Democratic Party, coming in from California on Sunday. Kamala Harris, yeah?
Yeah, she's planning to come in Sunday, actually, at the same time as the WSB debate, which starts at around 5 o'clock. She'll be here at 5:30 for a get-out-the-vote effort, and I'm sure Councilwoman Bottoms will join her after the debate. But, you know, they're trying to, her supporters are trying to get as much national Democratic support as possible. They're trying to recruit some other high-profile Democrats to come down and really give her a late push, because they're trying to make this as much about Mary Norwood being a closet Republican as they can in these final days, trying to get the Democratic machine out. Because if you can get the core Democratic supporters out, someone like Councilwoman Bottoms should win.
So what about that? Is it helpful to have national figures inject themselves into a race like this, Kyle? Or do voters feel a certain kind of grumbling resentment that they don't want to have national people telling them what to do?
I wonder if there's not going to be a little bit of a backfiring here with Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City.
Yeah, he backed Bottoms.
And Senator Harris and others. John Ossoff, who doesn't live in the district either. Sorry, I couldn't avoid that.
Get over it already.
I couldn't help it. You know, I do wonder if there's not going to be a little bit of a backlash to that. And you saw my colleague, on my counterpart, Jay Bookman, writing and kind of pointing to that as saying, look, this is not how we ought to be going about settling these sorts of local races. And I think that's a healthy conversation for across the political spectrum.
Why?
To be having.
Why?
Well, because, you know, we used to say or still say all politics is local, right? But if we're going to base our vote for the mayor of Atlanta on what someone who is president from one party that one of the candidates says she doesn't belong to, but the other candidate says, oh, yes, you do. I mean, we've really gotten a long way from deciding this thing on, you know, what is each candidate going to do to help the city move around better, to help people help their quality of life get better and all that sort
well,
of
one
thing.
Of the
so I think that's a healthy
except
conversation.
Except one of the problems, and of course Bottoms went after Mary Norwood in terms of her party label in our debate this week, but mm-hmm. one of the problems there, Greg, is there's not a whole lot to differentiate these two on major issues. They,
right.
Their differences, well, Lori, you can weigh in. Their differences between them are more subtle than pronounced. It's a little tricky, and you've got to turn somewhere else to try to win this thing, right?
Yeah, I think they're very comparable in terms of their positions and their qualifications. And I think that, you know, some of the national figures coming can bring out voters that might not otherwise be engaged. That's, I think, the most optimistic goal, is to mobilize people and energize people. I don't think they're going to change people's minds.
But they might get them to the polls.
Right.
Yeah. Greg?
And that's exactly the purpose, and that's exactly why they're trying to get these high-profile Democrats. And also, you're seeing Keisha Lance Bottoms, who's before, you know, a couple weeks ago, her highest-profile endorsement was from Mayor Reed. And she has not been relying on Mayor Reed as much.
Who? Mayor Reed? He's not part of her campaign anymore.
Exactly. She's been distancing herself from him. And at one of the forums this past week said, I am not Kasim Reed's third term. I am going to be an independent person. I'm not a pixie dust candidate, is what she said.
And Jason Carter, who is supporting Bottoms, made a similar statement. He said, look, she isn't Kasim Reed. All of which goes to the fact that Kasim Reed had a big impact on getting her out of the field of 13 or whatever mm-hmm. it was, but in the runoff, his way of helping her in the early stages is playing against her.
Exactly. He used some very harsh rhetoric, attacking some of her other supporters, including some of the contenders that he attacked during the first round of the race, like Caesar Mitchell, he hasn't attacked Shirley Franklin, but some of the other supporters for Mary Norwood. He called Caesar Mitchell a loser. He went after Kathy Willard during the first round of the vote. He's been very, very much quiet about them in this second round of the vote because he doesn't want to, I think, risk alienating any more of their supporters who Keisha Lance Bottoms needs.
I thought there was another interesting story that came out this week in terms of this party labeling and all the effort the State Democratic Party has put into labeling Mary Norwood as a Republican, a Trump supporter. She, of course, says, are you kidding? I voted for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. That's what she tells us. And the story, Kyle, that broke that was fascinating, and maybe it was you, Bluestein, but I'll let you take it on, Kyle, was Steve Leibovitz, who was Bill Campbell's chief of staff, who's a very prominent attorney at Denton's here and has been involved in Democratic Party politics within the city for a long time. He made it, he said, this is bad. This, the Democratic Party of Georgia ought to stay out of this thing. And he said he was embarrassed to watch how they were behaving in this.
Yeah, I had sort of been watching all this involvement by the party and wondering, where is this really getting them? Is this really the kind of thing that helps the Democratic Party of Georgia in other elections down the road? I mean, it was, we've already discussed it, on policy-wise, you're not going to see a whole lot of daylight between these two candidates anyway. And so I thought it was very interesting that you saw that. It's very interesting that you've seen people like Cesar Mitchell, Shirley Franklin, Peter Amon, and now Kathy Woolard come out and give Democrats sort of the cover that they need to go vote for a Mary Norwood. I think that party is going to have some wounds to heal after this either way, and especially if Mary Norwood wins it and the party has gone out and spent all this money and to no effect even.
Mm-hmm. Democrats spent at least $100,000 back in 2009 trying to paint Mary Norwood as a closet Republican in that very close runoff with Kasim Reed. This year, I think they've spent well above that on TV ads, on radio ads, flyers that we're seeing. And the question is it getting stale? I mean, is this resonating? I'll be interested in that poll to see how many Democrats are backing Mary Norwood, because if these arguments are becoming stale, then Democrats have to kind of shift in these final days.
All right. I want to take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about where the tax reform bill may stand. We are not quite sure what they're going to be voting on throughout today and whenever else they continue their votes on this. In the meantime, you're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
As the flow of new migrants has slowed, harvesting the nation's crops has been left to an aging population of farm workers. And their health has suffered from decades of hard labor.
The slowdown is happening. You could just see your production drop, but it's difficult to really manage because there's not, the younger people aren't wanting to come in and work in this industry.
I'm Kelly McEvers. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 this afternoon here on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Lori Johnson, we're not quite sure what is in the tax bill that the Senate is going to vote on today, because clearly there have been some adds and maybe a few subtractions based on what they needed to win over those reluctant, the recalcitrant Republicans. But overall,
we don't know if they know what's in it when they're voting on it.
Well, actually, we kind of know that there are some who've said we're not quite sure what we're voting on at this point. But it does appear now it's going to pass. But that doesn't mean it's a done deal, does it?
No, it doesn't. It goes to reconciliation, and it will certainly be interesting to see how they, you know, the House and the Senate versions end up getting melded. But I think, you know, there's some things that are clearly going to happen. The corporate tax cut's going to happen. And some of the other changes that are not controversial within the Republican Party, we know those are going to come through.
Okay, so we now have an analysis of this bill that the nonpartisan analysis, Kyle, which does say this thing is going to, we've already known it was going to increase the deficit to more than $1 trillion. But the argument that Republicans have made, and that I think you in many ways have probably supported, that growth because of the lowered corporate tax rate will make up for this enormous deficit, the analysis right now is that maybe 0.8% of that deficit will be recouped by economic growth, or there will only be 0.8% of economic growth, leaving a big deficit.
Yeah, the analysis shows us about a third of the static cost when you do the dynamic analysis is recouped. And, you know, I think that's probably, if you're realistic about how this stuff works, that's probably about right. I mean, even Art Laffer will tell you, not every tax cut pays for itself, and most of them don't. So that's a talking point that's kind of gotten away from Republicans over
years.
It's taken on a life of itself. So the question becomes, is it worth adding that debt over 10 years, if it really will spark the economy. And one thing I think is certain, and the argument is over how to get it, but I think one thing is certain is we will always have a debt problem if we are going to produce 2% economic growth a year, as we have for more than 10 years at this point. The Obama administration, I don't mean to pin this on him personally, this is just the way it lines up. That was the first presidency in decades and decades, if not ever, that never had one full year at 3% growth.
Yeah.
So if we can't get to that, that's the goal. Now, how do you get there? Does this bill get you there? I think those are very valid questions, and I'm not sure they've been fully answered. But to the extent that it's a matter of, well, can you add any debt along the way? If you get to that point, then yes, I think it's worth it. If you're going to fall short of it, and you know from the beginning you're going to fall short of it, I don't know that you can really justify that cost.
It's going to be interesting, Greg, to see when this thing goes back to the House, whether any of those numbers scare the real conservative, the deficit hawks on the House side. Lori mentioned there will be a conference committee on this most likely, which I think it's one of the reasons the White House has pushed to try to have the House accept the Senate bill and call it a done deal. I don't know that that's going to happen with these numbers out there.
I don't think so either. And it goes to the point that Todd Rehm, one of your guests on Wednesday, said. He said this for Republicans not to be shocked if this goes well into next year, because this is a very complicated process with lots of moving parts. And as you mentioned, we still don't know what the final bill today will look like because there's so many amendments still out there. And some of these are major amendments. Donald Trump wants the corporate tax rate to be reduced to 20%. He said that is a finite line. That is a must do. But Senate Republicans are pushing it to maybe 22%, 23% based on different proposals they have.
Well, in part because this figure, this deficit, this 1 point whatever trillion deficit figure has scared them a great deal. They're even looking down the road at whether they're going to have to include in this bill some tax increases at some point to help recover some of that lost money.
Right, which, you know, most people understandably think if you have that potential in the future, if what you're trying to do is shape business and corporate behavior by your tactics and your statutes, then the threat that this might all go away is not going to help you shape that behavior. But I don't think there's any economist who thinks we can grow our way out of this deficit. We're going to have to talk about spending, and Republicans know that, Democrats know that, but they don't seem to want to tell the voters that. You know, this tax cut is going to have to be paid for somehow. And those conversations are difficult, but just as a matter of conscience, it, I think, needs to be on the table as well. What is it we're going to cut?
You know, I went back, Kyle, and looked at the numbers after the last big tax reform measure, which was the Reagan bill in the mid-80s, which was also very, very hard fought and almost didn't get passed. And in fact, there was a significant amount of economic growth after he reduced what was a skyrocketing corporate tax rate and brought it way down. But it didn't sustain. And in the long run, the deficit did start creeping back up. So there was short-term gain, and at least you could tell there was some argument for cutting corporate taxes can lead to growth if everything goes your way, but it's got to all go your way.
Well, I think, and I was not a reporter at the time. I was a little bit younger. But my understanding of that is there were supposed to, you know, you had President Reagan in the White House, and you may have still had Republicans in charge of the Senate up to that point, but certainly not the House. You had Democrats in charge of the House. There were supposed to be some spending cuts that came along with that tax reform that never materialized. I think, you know, the Reagan, especially if you go back to some of the earlier tax changes they make, you had 7 or 8 good years of sustained growth all told out of that package. And I think that's probably all you can expect from the kinds of changes that you're going to get like that, you know, which are incidental to the other fundamentals of the economy and what's going on with the technology and trade, you know, everything else that affects it. I do think, you know, going back to what I said earlier, the growth rate has to go up. Spending does have to come down. if the growth rate is higher, that spending conversation is going to be a lot easier to have. For one thing, you won't have as much to have to cut. But two, you'll have, you know, if the growth rate is higher, you have more people employed, fewer people depending on government programs and that sort of thing. So that's an easier conversation to have
all
at
right.
that point.
All right. You want to make one last comment on this and we'll move on, Greg?
Yeah, that goes. I mean, I was going to just expand on a point Lori made earlier. This isn't just a tax cut. I mean, this will fundamentally change entire parts of the American economy. If you look at just higher education, the House bill ends the deductibility of tuition waivers for graduate students, repeals the deduction for interest paid on student loans, would tax investment earnings from university endowments. I mean, that's just one sector of the economy, higher education. Huge changes. So.
Yeah.
And those are going to be able to be tracked. And the same with the corporate. I mean, even if you support the corporate tax decrease, we'll be able to track whether companies are actually using that money to invest in hiring and building and growing this economy or whether they're going to give it to shareholders. Those are things that the Republicans are going to have to own because we will be able to tell. And I think they have underestimated how much people are attached to the tax benefits that they're used to getting. And the consequences
things like
for
salt,
higher education,
like state and local sales tax,
exactly.
local tax, income tax exemptions, and the education tax breaks for interest on student loans, that sort of thing.
Those are going to affect a lot of people, and there is no question who they will point to with the responsibility for them.
All right. While they're debating and trying to finish up the Senate version of the tax bill, there's another major money issue going on in Washington that really has a pretty profound impact here in Georgia. Those are the healthcare part. We've discussed them briefly on the show, but suddenly they're becoming more critical. We've talked about the fact that there are a number of healthcare programs that Georgians take advantage of, federal funds used to help vulnerable populations with health care needs. And money for these programs, the House and Senate have both said they've given their stamp of approval to continuing these programs, but they haven't found where they're going to get the money to do it. Now, maybe after the tax bill is done, they'll find it. I don't know. But among other things, the CHIP program, which we call Peach Care here, which Greg provides health care for children of families who are below the poverty line. Right now, the money for that is continuing, but it's getting close to running out. That's a problem for Georgia, right?
Yeah, there's still no date for a vote, as far as I know, on extending those. And then there's questions, as we mentioned earlier, about how the tax cut affects the healthcare side of the equation too. One estimate was some 13 million people could lose healthcare via the elimination of a plank of the Obamacare, and insurance premiums could rise 10% for some recipients.
Yeah, so-called rural extenders are part of that too, Lori. And again, I turn to you because you have a certain a swath of rural Georgia around you in Macon. The rural extenders help hospitals in rural areas, obviously, that are taking care of a lot of patients who don't have private insurance. And this federal money helps them deal with the cost of that. And that program is about to expire, too.
Right. I mean, you know, this harkens to me back to the quote of keep government out of our healthcare system. Well, you know what? Government is underpinning a lot of the cost of our healthcare system already, but people don't realize it. And so when these programs start to get cut and funding doesn't show, then they're going to feel those effects. And the question is, what will be the position and the opinion then? But yeah, it's a common problem that people don't appreciate the government support of programs until it's not there anymore. And then they may become active and they may become vocal and realize what's at stake. But until it's not there, they don't understand.
Kyle, Grady Hospital is one of the hospitals that also benefits from federal help, because they service, as do a lot of trauma centers, a disproportionate percentage of patients who have no way to pay for their care.
Yeah.
And they could lose a lot of money if this program isn't restored for them.
Yeah, I mean, this is our annual-ish dance that Congress does. And are they going to continue the budget at the current level? Are they really going to make some cuts? Are they you know, could they get themselves together and actually pass appropriations bills as they're supposed to do? The House did that, I believe. The Senate is what is really just fallen down on the job with that. I did want to point out that the number that Greg threw out there earlier about the 13 million losing their health care, to be clear, the CBO says it's 13 million people who would choose to stop obtaining health insurance if the individual mandate went away. And look, the CBO has consistently overestimated the strength of the individual mandate. They've consistently overestimated how many people are going to sign up on the exchanges and through other means based on the existence of the individual mandate. They're every year they're bringing those estimates down. So I think that's probably overstated. Now, the flip side of that is that's what the Republicans are relying on for a big pay for in their tax cuts. If you don't expect as many people, because the subsidies are still going to be there. It's just CBO thinks, oh, a bunch of people will stop taking them. They even say some people will stop taking Medicaid, which has nothing to do with your taxes. Yeah. So the flip side is the tax savings are not really going to be there. The deficit is going to be worse if you don't think the mandate is that powerful.
And the idea that people would voluntarily go without insurance has consequences for all of us. That's how insurance works. And so to sort of pretend that isn't going to have consequences for the healthcare system and the economy if people choose to go without insurance is also problematic.
Well, it's certainly a problem. Yes, I agree with that. And my point is that the evidence, our experience with the individual mandate suggests that the number will be nothing like 13 million people.
All right. The big issue here, though, is that you're right. These programs, the Senate's got to get its, excuse me, the Senate's got to figure out where they want to find the money to do this, and because they've already expressed interest in it. Isn't as if there are anybody, and there really aren't that many people up there saying, oh, let's dump all these programs. They're worried about where the money is coming from. Is that a fair way to say it?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Take this tax cut out of the equation. You're still looking at $500-600 billion of borrowing this year. So, yeah.
All right. Let's talk about Karen Handel. Karen Handel has now been one of those calling for a complete overhaul of the congressional process for handling harassment cases. And at the same time, the House Ethics Committee is starting to ask for records of harassment cases. Where, Lori Johnson, is all this going up there, where there have been so many apparent cases of harassment that have remained anonymous, where there's, we've learned, been a $15+ million slush fund to pay for settlements in harassment cases. In the current environment, you're not going to be able to get away with that much longer, are you?
Right. I think the expression, the chickens have come home to roost, comes to mind that, you know, and businesses have operated this way for decades, where settlements and confidentiality agreements and putting things behind in exchange for money. But it's a little different when you're elected officials, and using taxpayer money to do it is very problematic. And it's a process that's needed more transparency and exposure for a long time. So I think it's good that it's coming, but I don't think there are any winners in the process.
And for Representative Handel, this is kind of a throwback to her past campaigns. Remember in 2010, she ran on a sex, lies, and lobbyists sort of crusade against the good old boys in the Atlanta establishment. She made that a little bit a part of her campaigns for Senate and U.S. House, too. So this is really one of the first bigger steps she's taken since that June 20th special election victory.
So we'll watch that unfold. I don't think there's much question that she's on an issue that's going to gain traction up there. And in fact, Greg,
it'll be beneficial for other women candidates too.
Interesting, and it's certainly getting it done certainly wouldn't hurt her in her bid to win the seat outright for a 2-year cycle in 2018. You think?
Yeah, and so far, I mean, we have John Ossoff still sitting on the sidelines. He hasn't made up his mind, but there are three male candidates in that race. And so, Democrats who are not John Ossoff, who might be higher profile, are sort of waiting for him to make up his mind. But this is an issue that I think she can gain a lot of traction with over the next year.
While we're talking about that issue, John Conyers, who is one of those people who took advantage of this slush fund and use taxpayer, essentially taxpayer money to pay off some settlements for harassment. You know, we've now gotten to the point where the minority leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi, and many other leading Democrats have said Conyers has to out and out resign. He so far has said he won't do it, but a story has just moved saying an attorney for Representative Conyers said Friday that Conyers will make a decision in the coming days about whether to resign amid allegations of sexual harassment. The quote is, "We will discuss the next day or so what Mr. Conyers plans to do." Conyers, Kyle, is actually hospitalized right now, apparently because the stress of all this is, he's old.
Yeah, but this is his.
And he's been there a long time.
This is his 27th term, I believe. He's the only remaining member of Congress who was there when LBJ was president.
Yeah. So, you know, we're going to see what happens there. But it's going to be hard, isn't it, Lori, for him to hold on at this point?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the voters in his district clearly understand the value of seniority, but it's still, it's time, you know, to go peacefully into that good night.
Yeah, all right. We're almost out of time. Another couple quick hits. Greg, it looks like Jerry Wood, who's been the longtime mayor of Roswell, finally stepped down from that role.
After a judge forced him to.
That's right. Thank you for reminding me.
He's not allowed to run again.
That's right. The judge said, you're out of here. It looks like he's going to run against Republican Betty Price for a seat in the state legislature. Betty Price being, of course, Tom Price's wife.
Yeah, and a physician. And I guess she's, served one term or two
terms?
Yeah,
I think she's in her, I think only two,
I think she served,
two terms.
I think she's in her first or second full term.
Yeah.
She entered in a special.
But this
election.
Is a fascinating
Sweetest
race.
Betty. Tell us.
But this is a fascinating race with two brand name politicians up in that conservative leaning Roswell based district. You know, Jerry Wood's been mayor for 20 years. So in that district, he's very, very well known. And of course, Betty Price, the Price name is sort of household name in that. I mean, Tom Price served for several terms in the 6th District, and Betty Price has an election of her own under her belt. And both of those candidates have gotten in the hot water. Betty Price for her controversial comments about HIV quarantines, and Jerry Wood for not wanting to
ever stop being mayor. All right, listen, we are completely out of time for today's show. Thank you so much, Lori Johnson, for joining us from the Macon Bureau down there. It's great to have you on the show. Have a good weekend, Lori. And you too.
Thanks.
Kyle Wingfield. We'll look forward to your column on Sunday, which sounds, as Greg Bluestein said, kind of spooky.
Yeah, so maybe it is.
And Greg Bluestein, I was going to wish you a happy weekend.
A UGA
but I know
victory
you.
Tomorrow.
Oh,
just wish me that.
Your big Auburn game tomorrow. But you're going to be working all weekend on the mayor's
Sunday.
Race.
Sunday.
Know that. All right. And I'm out of here. I'm Bill Nigut. We will be back here again at 2 o'clock on Monday with another edition of Political Rewind. Jackie Cushman will be here that day. Beth Shapiro, Brian Robinson. That will be fun. We'll see you on Monday at 2. Have a great weekend, everybody.